AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
From the home of NASCAR's Dick Trickle, locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM, your news, talk, and sports station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Monica Ricks in New York. Congress has till the end of the day Friday to avoid disrupting work and services for millions of federal workers. CBS's Skylar Henry is on Capitol Hill.
Speaker Kevin McCarthy worked through the weekend and is optimistic about a breakthrough, though a handful of hardline conservatives say they're not interested in backing a stopgap measure, as the GOP-led House failed to reach a consensus on a short-term funding bill several times last week. Democrats say they've held up their end of the bargain.
Some big sticking points include funding for Ukraine and disaster relief. Ophelia's weakened to a post-tropical storm, but it's still causing problems in the Northeast. CBS's Astrid Martinez has that story.
Tens of thousands of people along the East Coast are still without power after dealing with 24 hours of destructive winds, heavy rain, and severe flooding. In Virginia, a state of emergency was declared. Overnight in North Carolina, roads were submerged. More than 40 car accidents reported in Raleigh.
No one was killed there, but a tree did fall on a car, landing the driver in a hospital. The mayor of El Paso, Texas, says his city is now reaching a breaking point over border crossings, with as many as 8,000 migrants coming into the U.S. every day. Here's CBS's Manuel Bajorquez.
At the root of it all is a mass displacement of people due to political and economic crises. More than 7 million Venezuelans have left their homeland in recent years, many heading to Central and North America.
Mexico says it's agreed to deport some of these migrants from northern cities to help combat the sharp rise. The writer's strike in Hollywood could end at any moment. The Writers Guild and studios have been negotiating all weekend and are now in their final phase of an agreement. Meantime, auto workers have now walked off the job in 20 states. Wayne State University business professor Merrick Masters weighed in on negotiations.
As long as the union isn't insistent upon getting retiree health care, defined benefit pension plans, and a 32-hour work week per se, then I think that all of the parties can come to an agreement.
The auto strike's in its second week.
Touchdown. I repeat, DDL.
NASA's OSIRIS-REx released a capsule containing the biggest sample of an asteroid to date. Dante Loretto was the mission's principal investigator.
Not only did we bring this mission in on schedule, under budget, and delivered more science than we had even thought was possible with the encounter with Bennu, but we think we've got a lot of sample in that science canister, and we can't wait to crack into it.
Bennu is the name of the asteroid. The sample landed in Utah today after a seven-year journey. This is CBS News.
You need to hire fast and hire right? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Making an Impact, sponsored by Grainger. One man's random act of kindness helped a recent widow pay it forward.
Somebody to do something that nice for you on that very moment when I thought nothing could make me happy again. It just touched my heart. If he can do this, I can do this.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers professional-grade supplies and solutions made for every industry and backed by product experts. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
Every piece of land has a story. For the Nelsons, it's cruising around their Montana ranch on a John Deere Gator XUV 835R. With 3,000 acres, there's plenty of work to do.
We're not afraid to jump in and help each other out.
That's how they've kept their ranch going for five generations.
It's all about efficiency.
Like teaching visitors to fly fish.
The whole joy with fly fishing is matching the hatch.
Run with us on a Gator XUV 835R and start telling your story. Learn more at johndeere.com/radio.
Over the Back Fence has moved. Tune in on Saturdays at 11 a.m. for an hour of water cooler talk, items you're looking to buy or sell, upcoming events in central Wisconsin, or just whatever. Join the conversation by calling 715-424-2600, and we'll go over the back fence at its new day and time, Saturdays at 11 a.m. It's the audio community bulletin board that comes to you. We'll see you there.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. Scattered thunderstorms likely tonight. Otherwise, cloudy skies expected. Lows level off around 57. Easterly winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Scattered thunderstorms likely. Tomorrow, highs level off around 67. Cloudy skies expected. Scattered thunderstorms again. Tomorrow night, 56. Overcast skies. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 66.
Hello, world. Welcome to WFHR's Director's Cut Session Something or Another. Your host and program director here, James J. Maloff. I am joined by my partner in art, our head of production, Seth Habager.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks once again for joining us today. And, I'm almost speechless. We have someone here that I'm a very big fan of. I followed the show that she was a part of for many years. I am a Misty. I will get that out of the way. James, tell them who we have with us today.
We asked the best audience radio to welcome to the WFHR stage best-selling author, Mystery Science Theater 3000 legend, Midwest's own Mary Jo Peel. Mary Jo, thanks for joining us.
Hello. I like best-selling author. That's, I don't know what your criteria is, but thank you for that.
Yeah.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here. Before this is all over, would you please send Seth and I to go watch a bad movie? Would you? No, I'm just kidding. Honestly, we will get to Mystery Science Theater in a little bit. I wouldn't
sure.
mind if we start off kind of where we like to on this show. Let's go back first. Would you mind telling us where you're from, a bit of your origin story?
Sure. I am from Circle Pines, Minnesota, which is about 20 minutes north of St. Paul. And when I was growing up, it was kind of a small town unto itself. And now it's sort of been subsumed into suburbia. It's a commuter town now. But I grew up there, and then I don't know where to start or where to end. What else can I tell you?
Right there is a great start. I think that's pretty good. Growing up out there, who were some of your first influences?
Oh, I loved the Carol Burnett Show. It really blew my mind. Mm. And then as I got into the preteen years, there was the Mary Tyler Moore Show. I would stay up all night and watch The Tonight Show. And I would also watch, when I was a kid, I was a babysitter in our neighborhood when I was in my early teens to mid-teens. And that was in the day of network television and running those old black and white movies late at night on a Saturday or Friday night. And I absolutely loved those. And so definitely was immersed in television culture.
To be fair, as a fellow Minnesotan, there's not much else to do in Minnesota, especially in small towns.
Yeah.
So
understandable. That's very understandable. Mary Jo, I think that, for a lot of us, when you're fortunate, like I was 7 years old, one of the worst days of my life. I'm watching TV and I see Mork and Mindy, and Robin Williams makes me laugh. And I knew right there, that's what I want to do. Like, I want to go that route. That's my path. But not everybody has that. You had a bit of some other things that you were going to do early on, and then you kind of went this route. Is that how it kind of went?
Well, it kind of found me. I tried to have a real job for years and years and years after college. I had no idea what I wanted to do, or I thought I was going to be in marketing, but I didn't even know what that really meant. And then I kept getting fired or laid off from jobs. I started my work life after college during a recession, and I couldn't. I mean, yes, some of it was my own failing. I would get fired from jobs, but also there were a lot of layoffs in whatever. I was in television sales for a while or as an assistant. So it was all that, and I just lurched from job to job, because my fantasy was that I would work downtown Minneapolis and have a really cute tote bag and somehow have long legs where I would stride knowingly to my job. I don't know what I was thinking. And then I was just about to get fired from another job, and a friend took me to an open stage. And this was the comedy boom of the mid-'80s in Minneapolis especially, but I think all through the United States. And I did memorized 3 minutes, forgot 2 minutes of it, and somehow I started getting work right away. And then I got fired from my job and just pieced together a living with these stupid $25 gigs 3 hours away, and I did some temp work too. So that's what I mean when I think it found me. I just somehow managed to get legs under that sort of freelance, doing stand-up comedy and doing a little bit of writing here and there. And I'm sorry, that's the very long answer to that.
No, it's a great answer.
That was wonderful.
With that being said, it's kind of a process that it kind of finds you. When did you realize, okay, I want to do this. I want to stay in this field. I want to keep doing this.
I think there's something really heady about when I was really shy when I was younger, and I had kind of this offbeat sense of humor. And when you go on stage and you are connecting with an audience as a really shy person, there's something really heady about it, especially if they're laughing, when you've been kind of a goofball your whole life. So it's intoxicating. And when the alternative was being in a day job, which I just could not figure out how to do clearly, when that was the alternative, I think that's when I started I never turned down work. So it just sort of escalated. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
It just sort of built on its own. So I think I was really lucky because I was and am fairly clueless, lurching from the next thing to the next thing. And I came from a really pragmatic family where you go to a job Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. So I was kind of figuring out new territory for my family's ethos.
Did you find growing up with that, maybe you didn't want to be in that environment, but that work ethic you are going to carry with you into this work, into the creative field?
Oh, God, that's a really good question. That's a really good question. Yeah, I think I did a fair amount of hustling once I got a bead on you have to make your own work and you have to connect. So I think that's a really great question. I think there was definitely an element of that. And I also learned from my peers to make connections and just do the writing and do the practice. Does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Does that get to your question?
Yes. You said something before that made me think of how there's nothing like making strangers laugh. Making our friends and family, that feels great. Making a little kid laugh, there's nothing like that. But there's something about, you said connecting with an audience, and I hadn't thought about that in a while as a performer, and there's nothing like that. Was it doing some stand-up stuff? Was it even acting that kind of gave you a little of that or gave you a taste of that?
I think it was definitely stand-up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where sometimes I also think, I don't want to get too hyper-analytical about it, but I'm the middle child of 5, and I come from a very vociferous family. And so sometimes I wonder if it was just my way of claiming my space having people, making people listen to me, even if they would heckle me or boo me, at least I had some control over.
You have some attention, finally.
Yes. I'm not being ignored. I'm not having to glamour over everyone. And I say that lovingly because I love my family. And we're very close.
So. Oh, that's wonderful. But no, I think she's got something there.
Yeah,
I think she does.
Writing, acting, singing, you do quite a bit creatively, especially hearing all this
other... I don't know where you got singing.
Oh, no. I'm not going to let you stay on that. Seth and I were listening to some of your music.
I'm sorry. We had music, but you know. We just watched your wonderful performance of Lovers Loving Love.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
With you and Bill that you did on MST3K. And we just had to get that in there. So don't sell yourself short.
I am not going to allow that. Mary, I should journalistically get this out there. You have one of my favorite voices in TV history. I not just singing, but your voice just in general. There's no journalistic integrity here. I'm going to be a little bit all over the place on this stuff.
Seriously, because I have to tell you that I just did the audio version of my book, Dum Dum Dum. And now I'm listening to it. And maybe you can agree with that it is really hard to hear your own voice.
Yes.
I think most people say that about having to listen to themselves. And I feel like I really have a monotone or a specific rhythm. When I think of my voice actor, my professional voice actor friends. So I thank you for that. And also, I was able to wedge in a little plug there. Nicely done.
She's a that sales marketing you did early on in your career.
It's showing.
Do you have, along with all of these things, do you have other creative outlets? Do you like to knit? Do you have other things you like to do?
No, every long Minnesota winter, I come up with a craft project that I'm going to do, and then I pretty much work creatively all day on riff track stuff or new projects, so I'm kind of topped out, although I know I should be cooking or knitting or something. I think in the summer, what I really like to do, although it's not necessarily creative, is I'm on my bike all the time in summer, so that's my dealio. And then in winter, I try and figure out some sort of, I don't know, my sisters tried to get me into puzzles and I couldn't stand it. So that's a really good question. I think I get really frustrated with myself because I don't know. I will hang up and listen.
I work too much, and my little sister has been on me about finding other creative outlets, and so she likes to do coloring and do puzzles. So she's been on me about the same things, about like puzzles and color. She's sending me like links to these little kids' books and things, and like, Jill, I don't know. You brought up your book earlier. I'd like to go right there, if you don't mind. How did writing your first book come about? You've talked about how these things kind of find you. How did this one find you?
Well, the first book I wrote, I do not talk about because it was riddled with typos, and I didn't know how to write a book. I don't even know how many words it is, but it is about the size of a pamphlet, and the publisher had to enlarge the font to make it slightly more substantial. And my great story about that book is that they misspelled my name in it. And when I caught it in the proofs and brought it up to the publisher, he said, "But we fact checked it."
That ain't right. No, that's
it kind of speaks to my whole career. Like, it's just kind of there, but I don't really, you know, I've been so lucky, but I never quite, you know, make it. I don't know. So then my second book is Employee of the Month and Other Big Deals. And by this time, I had accumulated a body of work writing for Minnesota Monthly in a monthly column for a couple of years. So I took a lot of those columns and sort of tweaked them or enlarged them and added some new ones. And then I had a professional editor, and a friend of mine designed the cover, which I absolutely love. So it was thrilling to me that people were so willing to help me out on it and make it a better a better thing. And then, I submitted to a small publisher, or I submitted a proposal to a small publisher, and the premise is that my mom was, it's a memoir, my mom was an avid reader, and after she died, we found this recipe box full of index cards in which she kept track of all the books she read. Because she read so much, she started forgetting, so she kept her little card catalog.
Wow.
And yeah, and the little comments, so she makes comments about the plot or how she reacted to it, and there's a scale that she uses, and some of the comments are so hilarious and so pissy, and when we found it, I think we found it a few months after she died, and my father gave it to me, and I just sat with it for a while, and I realized that you start rediscovering your parents. And I think that happens to a lot of people when they when they lose a parent, and all of a sudden you can't ask them the questions that only occur to you once they have passed. So that's that. Did I get to your question
yes,
at all?
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. Okay. Yes, okay. Absolutely. When it comes to that, and having a very strong relationship with my mother as well, and I have to mention that being the son of a Jewish mother, I have to fit it into the interview. How did you find? Did you find yourself like kind of finding things that you admired about her or appreciated about her more, or that you had missed before? There, we get so caught up in life and so close to these things, having some time away from it, coming back to it. Did you find that?
Oh, absolutely. I think you put it very well. Yeah, what I talk about a lot in the book is trying to distance myself from her, which I think might be a natural. I don't have children, so I suspect it's a natural occurrence where a kid is trying to find their own identity. And as I grew older, and then I got married later in life, so I started having life experiences that made me relate to my mother a little bit more. So absolutely, and I started having more, we were always pretty tight, but we had our moments, and I found myself just having more and deeper understanding of her as a person, someone much smarter and eloquenter than me said something like, your parents know you your whole life. You only know them for part of theirs. No.
Right.
Wait, did I say that right? Your parents know them. You know you.
Oh, I thought you said it right.
You said it right.
You said it right.
Did I say it right?
Yeah, I think you did. You got it.
Your whole life. You only know them for part of theirs. And I think as I grew older and then once she died, that really, and especially as I read these little book reviews and realized I had forgotten some things, and realizing, you know what, she was a three-dimensional human being who had dreams before she had five kids by the time she was 33. So,
Wow.
What is next for you? Are you working on anything now, writing-wise?
You know what I'm working on is, you know, I do riff tracks on a regular basis with my pal and colleague, Bridget Jones Nelson. And that's kind of a more e-version of Mystery Science Theater 3000. So that keeps me very busy. I'm going to redo Dumb 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 because when I was doing the audio version, I realized there were so many, again, typos and dropped letters, that kind of thing, you know, when you're trying to work on stuff and all this stuff comes to bear. The other thing I'm working on is my dad put up a little stage in my one stall garage. So there's a little backdrop and then a little wooden stage, and I've been having shows in my garage with my comedian and actor friends.
Oh my gosh.
And
oh, that sounds
that is
so
the
awesome.
Cutest reaction ever. Hey, send me your information and I'll put you on my my emailing list to let you know when the next show
I'm
is.
I'm sending it right now. Yes.
Yeah. No. And anybody else who wants to be on the mailing list, because it's a small audience. It's kind of a speakeasy situation where I only let you know the address until you like let me know you're coming.
Yeah.
So where was I going with this? So what I'm working on is I realized that my having started stand-up comedy was my own version of DIY, trying to figure out that life, and my dad building my little stage in my garage and. He can fix anything, and when he was 7 years old, he made Adirondack chairs.
Whoa.
So I'm trying to make a profile of, and it's my also my comedy special that no one asked for, but I'm going to do a comedy special in my garage and figure out a film around comparing it with my dad's sensibilities.
That is
know?
Such a cool idea.
Have I made any sense whatsoever?
Yes.
As you can see, I don't have the cut line yet for that. I don't have the elevator speech yet for what it is. So that's what I'm working on.
But I can hear it forming already, and I love the basis of it and the building literally from him building. Like that's very cool. That's really interesting. When it comes to advice, whether it's about writing or just in general, what's some of the more heartfelt or advice that has really carried you throughout your life here, your creative career especially?
Oh, wow. I don't know if I can suss out specific sentences of advice, maybe more attitudes, where you just have to do your thing. I'm sorry, I'm being very inarticulate as I think about that question. So a friend of mine found out that he's working on a show about an unseen illness, and then he saw that someone else was doing a friend show about their unseen illness, and he kind of texted me like, oh, great. And I felt like, well, everybody's going to have there's always going to be overlapping sensibilities or parallel creativity. If we all just stop doing what we're doing because somebody else is doing it, nothing would ever happen. So, and I remember people encouraging me along the way to that degree. I think the other thing is just really taking whatever you're terrified to try creatively. I think you should run into the belly of the beast and just do it. You know?
Nice.
Yeah.
No, what would you guys say? I mean, what have people told you along the way?
Ooh, that's the first time we've been asked
that. Yeah, I like that. Nicely done. Nicely done flipping it. That was good.
No,
that was
I'm really curious.
I would say, kind of piggybacking off of a little bit of what you were saying there, that one of the best things you can do is being you. I teach a little bit of improv, and I have students ask often, you know, how I want to be this or I want to be that. And I you know, try to make sure that they know there's nothing in the universe like you. Like, even if you have a twin, there's nobody else like you. So whatever your approach is going to be different than anybody else's. So even if you're telling a joke, how did the chicken cross the road, you're going to tell it differently than anybody else's. Your voice, your opinion, your take on it's going to be different. So I think that was one of the greater things to happen to me is realizing, similar to what you were saying, so early on creatively, I wanted to be different than everybody else. And I had to stand out. And I realized pretty early on, no, you kind of just do that already, man. You, for better or worse, you're pretty much your own person. Right. Be you, you know.
Well, yeah, it's like that scene in Life of Brian where the Jesus figure or Brian is telling the whole crowd, you're all different. And somebody says, I'm not. But and if I may quote Miles Davis, it takes you a long time to figure out how to play like yourself. I'm still finding my voice and taking those risks. And I think I think the thing I'm really avoiding saying is using the Nike phrase, just do it. Have to do it, because I meet a lot of people who say, I want to do stand-up comedy. I just don't know how to do it. Can you give me any advice? And the advice is, that is one of those things that you have to do. Write your ass off. I don't know, can I say that? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, you're fine.
Okay. If you want to write with pals or a writing group, go for it. But it still means you have to get up there. And to your point about improv, one of the best things I ever did, I was so, so shy as a young adult and into my 20s and early 30s. And I started taking improv classes. And that was the best thing I ever did, because it really makes you be in the moment and responsive and really alert to what is happening, not just on stage, but in your life. It's pretty cool. Wouldn't you say, don't you think there are skills beyond the stage when one takes improv?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've had attorneys take our classes before, just so that they can feel more comfortable speaking. And at the end of, as they're wrapping up, I'm sorry, Miles Davis is my favorite creative human being of all time. And I got to hear you quote Miles Davis. I may retire after this. I don't know. I'm a little speechless. I gotta be honest.
You're welcome.
I'm going to use that as a segue to take a break. We will go ahead and do that real quick. We'll come back with Mary Jo Peel here on Director's Cut at WFHR.
I was just curious as to why you called it the Paul Revere Show.
The Paul Revere Show is named this way because the poem that we all know, the famous Ride, the poem was written to rally the troops to fight slavery and fight for democracy. And so I named the show the Paul Revere Show because I thought it was the time to get on the air and talk about democracy.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m., always on the Civic Media app.
Sports allow us to play, learn, and grow. But there's something more important than victory. At the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, we believe every athlete deserves to be safe. Safe from abuse and misconduct on and off the field. We equip athletes, parents, coaches, and others with the right education to recognize, prevent, and respond to harmful behavior. Join the movement to champion respect and end abuse at uscenterforsafesport.org.
Welcome back to Director's Cut, everyone. Seth and James here. We are talking to Mary Jo Peel, best known, of course, as Pearl Forrester on Mystery Science Theater 3000. We had the first part of the show. We talked about kind of what she's doing now and some of the projects she's been working on, her book and some other things. But now we got to get to my favorite part of the show, where we get to talk about my favorite show of all time, Mystery Science Theater 3000. So, Mary Jo, we'll start at the beginning. How did you end up on the show?
I will tell you how I ended up on the show. I was doing stand-up comedy in the Twin Cities, and by this time I had been doing it a couple of years, and I was so broke I did not have a television, but I knew that a lot of the people that I had worked with on stages around town, like Joel, Mike, Bridget, Frank, Trace, I knew that they were all working on, and Josh Weinstein, yeah, I said everybody, yeah.
Yeah.
I knew they were all working on this show produced locally for local television when it was just first starting out on KTMA. And then Bridget, how did this go? So it was in production for a couple of years, and then one day Bridget and I were friends, and one day, in my memory, this is how it went. I was in my little studio apartment, and my landline rang, and it was Bridget. And in my memory, she had a hushed, secretive voice, but I don't think that really happened. She said, I just want to let you know that Mystery Science Theater is looking for another writer, and I think you should call Mike, but you didn't hear it from me.
Very clandestine,
so,
yes.
So, and yeah, totally. And I kind of knew what it was, but again, I'd never seen it. So then, I don't know, a day or two later, I mustered up all my courage, and I'm serious, because I was so shy and so reticent, and I feel myself getting anxious all over again, thinking about marshaling all my emotional forces to call up Mike Nelson, and we were friends, you know, like we worked together. But I called him up, and I said, in my most natural voice I could muster, I said, "Hi, Mike. So I hear you are looking for another writer, and if it's okay with you, I just want to throw my hat in the ring." And he said, you know, he's got this very great, calm voice, and he says, "Oh, yeah, Mary Jo, we have talked about you submitting materials for it, and I will let you know, you know, the next step." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Okay, thanks." And then I hung up and I threw up. And then they sent out a packet. How did this? Okay, sorry to belabor this story, but they sent out a packet to potential new writers where you had to do a portion of a movie, like make jokes for a portion of a movie. And I had to go rent a VCR and borrow a TV so I could play the VHS to see what it was all about. And then I passed that part of it. And then I went in for a two-week trial in the office and watching the movies. And then when the 2 weeks was up, nobody said anything to me. So I assumed that I hadn't gotten the job. Mm-hmm. And so I was going to be really professional about it, and I went around to everyone, and I said, "Thank you so much for this opportunity." And honestly, you guys, I think they forgot I was there on a trial basis, because the look on Mike's face was like, oh, yeah. So he went into a meeting with Trace and Jim Mallon and Joel, and they asked me to stay for another 2 weeks, and then I got it. So that's the long version. I'm sorry to belabor that, but how that happened.
We want all the details. All of it. Okay.
I can't get enough. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, I want more and more. You start as a writer. How did you get involved acting on the show?
We always did everything from within. We didn't really hire out a lot of parts when we were, it was so skin of the teeth and sort of let's put on a show in you know, the barn kind of sensibility, that we were always dragooning the prop people or the front office. And so I had done a couple of guest things with Bridget. We played the Amazon Moms, I think.
Yes,
and
yes.
I'd done little bits in the Hex Field. And by that time, I had done the bit where Trace's, Dr. Forrester's mother came to visit. So that was established. Mm-hmm. And then I think it just, when Trace decided to leave the show, I think there were other options thrown around, but that seemed like an organic evolution. Yeah. Did I get to your question?
Yes, you did. Yes. Oh, okay. So what was how did you feel pretty comfortable doing that early on? It doesn't sound like that was the plan going into this. You were going to be a writer, and did you know if I'm a writer, I'm probably going to be on the show?
Oh no. I never think that far ahead, and I was so blown away that I even got the job, that I didn't have to go on the road anymore for stand up, which was really grueling. And no, I never thought that far ahead. I kept a really low profile. I just worked really hard because I didn't want to get fired from another job, especially this one. So no, that's a really good question. No, I don't ever remember thinking, oh, I get to be on TV, because I don't think I would have been a little too shy to do that. That would have been too much to even think about that.
You know, Mary Jo, I love hearing you talk about how shy you were, because when I think about, you know, when you get into the role of Pearl, you know, as the main villain, seasons 8 through 10, it's like you and the camera were like made for each other.
Yes.
You played to the camera so well.
Yeah.
You did. And I know that's partially because of what Trace did with Dr. Forrester. But right. the way you did it, James and I were talking about before you called about how, you know, express, especially your eyes, how good your eyes were,
God, your eyes.
You know, doing being Pearl and how just wonderfully evil you were doing it. So that surprises me.
Thank you.
It surprises me that you say that.
But I think by that time I was comfortable working with my colleagues. I had known all those guys. I was getting the lay of the land and feeling comfortable in my job. I also, on some organic level, understood the tone of the show. I think if it were, believe me, I am not a subtle actress. So I think it was suitable for me, and I saw how the tone of the show and how it was being played, especially in Deep 13, if that makes any sense. I knew the notes to hit. That felt very organic to me.
Okay, now I have a question, and this is because I've never seen anyone ask this of you before, and maybe this is just my mistiness coming out. But so the show had two actual guest stars over the history of the original run of the show, just two, not in-house people, in other words. And you were the one that interacted with both of them. So I got to ask you, how was it working with, first of all, Leonard Maltin for his little bit that he did? And then my favorite one, Vikings running back Robert Smith, which is the weirdest thing. I mean, I know afterwards he said he was a big fan of the show. And I had no idea. Robert Smith?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
You know? But I mean, I got to know the dirt.
Say
what
more,
happened?
Say more like why that was so weird. Did it seem sort of just shoehorned in there? Like
that's true.
Trying to build a premise around the idea? What?
How did you guys meet? How did that? How did Robert Smith become
just being on stage with, you know, like, I mean, the Leonard Maltin one was fun because, you know, you guys in the past had kind of poked fun at him a little bit. So I'm kind of curious if that came up at all when you were doing the scene with Leonard Maltin.
It's been a while, but I do remember him just having a really good spirit about it and understanding the nature of it and having fun with it. And it was kind of a blur because I think I had just gotten home from Europe a few days. I went on a long trip a few days prior, and then when I got back, they told me I was going to L.A. to do that.
Okay.
And so it was kind of a blur, but he's just this really genial, smart guy who just had a great sense of humor about the whole thing. I mean, the movie we mock him about, he gave, whatever, 4 or 5 stars to. So he just has a really good sensibility about it.
That's very, very cool.
When I was little, I got to stay up late with my Nan and Pop and watch The Tonight Show as well. And watching that was a big influence on me, Johnny Carson, certainly. But it was the way that Johnny interacted with his guests. Certainly the famous interviews with Don DeLuise and Burt Reynolds and, you know, Frank Sinatra, some of those. But it was Don Rickles for me. That really was one of the ones, because I'd never seen anybody be able to own the stage like Don Rickles did. When he came out there, it was like everybody was like a prize fighter was coming out, and everybody was like kind of just getting their shields out and getting ready. And as a kid, I wanted Don Rickles to insult me. That was one of those things I wanted. Not since then have I wanted somebody to do something.
That's hilarious. Okay.
Since that, I hadn't had anything like that until seeing you in Mystery Science Theater and wanting you to look into the camera and send me to go watch a bad movie. Like that, it was that in between time. So when you talk about kind of not you know, necessarily wanting to do this early on, or it finding you and not even really thinking about being on camera, I'm curious, and I hope you know, you're good. This is one of the things I think that you were born to do. Have you gotten more comfortable on stage, on camera? Do you feel better about that and more comfortable in your own skin when doing these things?
Definitely on stage. I don't think I've had that much, very few on camera opportunities. Maybe I did a commercial a couple of years ago, but it was a whole different, it was a whole different character where I had to play a senior citizen who couldn't get up the stairs because of a heart issue.
It's rough. It's rough.
Be that as it may, I feel much more at home And you're right. Much more comfortable in my own skin on stage because my comedy has evolved, my storytelling has evolved, where I feel much more like I'm having a conversation with the audience. I'm relating to the audience instead of just getting on stage. And I just had my rat-a-tat series of jokes that I just wanted to get through because I was so nervous and just wanted to get off stage. And now I feel like I'm just more present and having just relating to people and telling honest stories, if that's answering your question at all.
Has that confidence that you've grown to have transferred to your personal life at all?
Yeah, I think confidence is a really interesting word because I'm not sure it's necessarily confidence as much as it is not caring anymore.
Yes.
And I don't mean that in a bad way.
No.
Mm-hmm. I mean that there are so many things out of one's control, and I think you get to a certain age where you're just willing to, boy, I'm talking myself into a corner, and I'm being very, very splitting hairs about the semantics. I think I just, I am less, can I write a white paper on this?
Yes, send it to us, yeah.
We'd like it by Friday. We would like it by Friday.
Of confidence. It's also an element of my heart and my spirit not being so shut down with anxiety. Mm-hmm. I just feel a little more open to the world and people, and things are what they are. And I'm going to shut up right there because I'm sounding really weird.
No,
I'm not very articulate, and I apologize.
No, not at all.
I think you're sounding relatable. That's how you come across to us, at least.
Yep.
What was the writer's room like on The Satellite of Love?
Oh, my God. When I think of having landed that job, I'm still in disbelief. Well, it was a 9-to-5 job where I got to go and watch old bad movies with the funniest people I ever knew, the smartest people I ever knew. So I got to be creative with all these people. They were so smart and so funny. I had to work harder to keep up, which I will always be grateful for. Mm-hmm. We're still all really close friends. So you would get there at the beginning of a writing cycle and sit down on these big old couches and watch a movie and laugh your head off. And, you know, Frank would always stay up all night. He's a night owl. So we'd start work at 9, and then at 10, he'd be like, when are we breaking for lunch? we always took a really early lunch. And it was great. If you have more specific questions, I feel like I'm painting with a really broad brush right now, but it was like unbelievable. Who has a job like that?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I apologize. I try to be broad so that you have plenty of room to move. I should be more specific.
No.
I'm not a professional interviewer.
Don't apologize. It's just like I feel like I'm rambling because it's a hard job to describe. I mean, sometimes you get really overwhelmed if you're working with the Manos Hands of Fate and you have to do line assign, and it's such a terrible movie, but who's complaining? People should have such problems.
You mentioned something there. Was it you were for, I remember reading somewhere for a while, was it you and Paul Chaplin that were the line assigners for the three guys in the theater?
Yeah, Paul and I, and then Frank usually was going through a box of screeners because this was old school when the Comedy Central or the Sci-Fi Channel would send you a box of VHS tapes for possible movies they could get. So that was what Frank was doing while Paul and I were doing line assign.
Very interesting.
Very, very nice. So I'm glad we actually, James, brought that up, because that was, you know, of course, the original run of the show through the 90s on Comedy Central and then Sci-Fi Network. But now, recently, you've been a part of the revival, the big, you know, Kickstarter campaigns and all that stuff that Joel himself has been behind. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know out there, they have three seasons now have been put in there. How is it different? You know, it's interesting, as popular as the show was, or as popular as it got, I should say, back in its original run, it seems to have only gotten bigger as the years have gone by. And now you look at the shows you guys have done since then and during the revival, and you've got big stars coming out to guest star, and you've got big writers who want to work on the show, and you're working with regulars like Patton Oswalt and Felicia Day and stuff. That's got to be very different from it was back in the day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, back in the day, it was very much catch-as-catch-can sensibility with making props and, like I said, using people in the office to play different parts. Mm-hmm. And this, clearly, an enormous budget. I remember walking in the first iteration of the new iteration, and it was this giant studio in L.A., and this huge satellite of love and huge crew doing all this stuff, and that was a little jarring. I mean, I was totally there for it, but mm-hmm. just extremely, extremely different. And also the writing, I don't think I wrote for that first iteration. I just showed up for it, to be on it. And the writing for this last iteration was all done via Zoom, which for me did not have the same connection as sitting in a writing room and easily bouncing ideas off each other.
Mm-hmm. Mary Jo, what is a lasting memory for you of the show?
What is a lasting memory?
Yeah. I immediately regret asking. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Listen, I am put on. I feel put on the spot all the time.
Mary Jo, what's the meaning of life? What's the? go ahead, do that.
I don't think it's one specific thing. I think it's the general idea that I had a job for 7 years where I got to laugh every day really hard, and. Like I said, I'm still amazed that it sort of still has this half-life where I get asked to appear at conventions or sign stuff, which blows my mind every single time. Who would have thought that? And then people say, I really hate to ask you this, but could you sign my whatever? And my feeling is like, are you kidding me? I'm happy to. Who gets to do this? So I don't, you know, so many of these questions, I'm going to wake up in the middle of the night and think, oh, yeah, that was the answer to that. I get way overthinky about stuff, so I apologize.
It just means you got to come back.
I'd love to.
James is already angling for that second one. You know, you talked a little bit about, you know, the camaraderie of the show, the original run of the show. And it something occurred to me the other day. You're kind of like the one that's in touch with all of them still. Mm-hmm. You know, you're on the new show, the new iteration with Joel and that group over there. You do Riff Tracks, which, for those who don't know, that's kind of the Mike and Kevin and Bill, you know, kind of got together. I think mm-hmm. Mike was the one that started it. And you do the similar things, and you would do riffing on movies like you did in MST3K, and you and Bridget, like you've mentioned, have a whole bunch on there. I love them, by the way. I yours and Bridget's are my favorite, and I'm not just saying that. I love them so much.
Well, thank you.
So I just rewatched The Farm Family in the seasons with my oldest son, and he loved them. He thought it was great. But
I love the farm family stuff. Yes. Go ahead.
But you know, you also have a connection with Frank and Trace with their Mads Are Back thing. You know, you're on the Dumb mm-hmm. Industries. You're connected with that. So you're kind of like the tissue now that still connects all the group together. And I mean, it's wonderful to hear that, you know, everyone still kind of stays in touch. You know, you and Kevin and Bill made on the new show. You guys showed up on your characters there, and you're still, you know, mm-hmm. doing things for each other and that sort of thing, which that's got to be great. I mean, considering how show business is and how project by project it can be, I think it's wonderful that that you guys have been able to kind of hang it together.
Yeah, I feel really, really lucky that way. I knew all of them before MST, mm-hmm. so I think there was always that connection in the first place. And I think we just make each other laugh. We have a shared mm-hmm. sensibility. I think we did before the show. I think the show cemented that. So yeah, I. And that's what I mean about who would have guessed that I'd still be getting to do this, you know, doing riff tracks and the streaming show with Dumb Industries. So,
We're so thankful that you are still doing this stuff we're enjoying every bit of it. We have one last question for you, Mary Jo, and you're all done until the second time you join us. I want to encourage people, though, wherever you get your books, be sure to get, read, enjoy Employee of the Month and other big deals. And, of course, a recent release, Dumb, 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 My Mother's Book Reviews. My mom is a big fan of that book, by the way. And encourage
you. Are you serious?
Yes.
That is so sweet. Oh, my gosh. Did she point out any of the dropped words or typos? Was she mad about
Surprisingly,
that?
No, but that's only because I didn't write it. Like, if I had written it, then definitely. Yes, she definitely would have. I love you, Mom. So be sure to follow her on Twitch as well, Mary Jo Peel. Just throw that in there, and you'll find it, and keep up with all the riff tracks and everything that she is up to. Mary Jo, our final question for you. If you could have coffee with any historical figure, who and why?
Shut up.
Yep.
No, I am so bad at these questions. Historical?
Yeah.
Okay, does Paul Rubens count? Because I am heartbroken about
absolutely
him.
Counts.
I mean,
absolutely.
He was so formative to my sensibilities that you don't even realize until when he died, I thought, oh my gosh, it wasn't just that he informed my sensibilities. It's kind of like he gave permission to be this goofball and crazy. And Pee Wee's Big Adventure, I felt like, was written and done for me personally. I just loved that movie. That's the long answer.
Oh,
that's the one off the top of my head. So.
If we could sneak.
I have a question for you guys. Who would it be for you guys?
Oh, okay.
Oh, good one. Good one.
Oh, so I'm making you go first.
Okay. All right.
Because I think you know it. Mine changes a lot. So,
yeah. You made me think of Phil Hartman with Paul Rubens. And that's one that I hadn't thought of before. But gosh, that would be a nice one. I have to go with Robin Williams because he is my guy. And he's the reason I'm in this chair right now and a big reason. So I get out of the way, though. What do you got, Seth?
I'm thinking of comedians right now because we're talking to a comedian. And one of my all-time favorites was an old radio comedian by the name of Fred Allen.
Oh, wow.
Known as a master improv guy himself, an ad libber. He was one of the best topical comics of his day. Mm-hmm. He had this pinched Boston accent voice, which is wonderful. So I would love to talk to Fred Allen if I ever had the chance. He's the guy to do.
I think the next time we do this, Mary Jo should interview us. she may have asked better questions. Yeah. She may.
Hers is much more interesting.
I was just piggybacking off you guys because that's one of the problems I have with interviews is I'm just really interested in people. I wanted to know more about you guys, but next time, I will lead the interview.
Sounds good. You've been the best. Thank you so much for joining us, Mary Jo. We appreciate the time.
My pleasure. It was so fun talking to you guys.
All right. Well, with a big thank you to Mary Jo Peel and of course, for all her future endeavors, we do wish you the best of luck. And we will be talking to her again, apparently. Wait for that, everyone. Thanks for joining us today on Director's Cut.
Locally grown 1320 AM and 97.5 FM WFHR programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Do you catch yourself quoting TV shows like that? It could win you a free meal and make you our next star of the day with Culver's. Join the morning show on WFHR every Friday.
What you talking about, Willis?
My name's James, and I'm telling people every Friday we'll play a theme song or a quote from a movie.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a...
You call 424-2600, give the correct answer, and you'll win a family pack from our Wisconsin Rapids Culver's.
To the Batmobile.
Join the morning show every Friday for Culver's Star of the Day.
I love it when a plan comes together.
Here's your forecast from locally
WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.